for Jews around the world who saw themselves as belonging to a religion, but not necessarily a people, who saw themselves cut off, unable to travel to, unable to communicate with other Jews, to read from this literate, well-known, brilliant Western journalist and playwright, "We are a people, one people." That got into their kishkes. That got into their guts.
Dr. Pelissart, in this third lecture, you're going to introduce us to the Jewish state. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the creation of the book?
So, a big part of the story of Herzl's The Jewish State is the creation of the book, because it wasn't a situation in which he sat down and decided, I need to write a book, and that book is going to launch the Jewish movement. It actually started out as notes for a meeting with Baron Hirsch, 22 pages of single-spaced notes. And his belief at the time was that what he needed to do was to bring in one of the leading Jews, which at the time meant a Western European Jew, a businessman, philanthropist, and that person would do everything top-down. And when it didn't work with Hirsch, he then started in a real passionate, not a fury, but in a wave of what he referred to as inspiration, began writing out an address to the Rothschild family. He was going to speak to the Rothschilds as a group and persuade them that this was their project and it was going to save their fortune and the Jewish people's national fortune. And so for quite a number of weeks, what he was working on were first notes on scraps of paper, later assembled by his father, and turned into the address to the Rothschilds. But a fascinating thing happened on the way to not making it to an audience with the Rothschilds, which is at a certain stage he realized this wasn't going to work top down. This was going to work because Jewish people from around the world, including the less fortunate Jews of the Pale of Settlement in Eastern Europe, they would get their hands on this pamphlet, on this book, and they would ultimately demand the Jewish state, and they would be its foot soldiers. So something that started as notes for a salon-style meeting with an individual and then with a small and wealthy family turned out to be a book that Herzl then started actively seeking to get translated into multiple languages so that the Jews of Russia could read it in Yiddish or in Hebrew, and the Jews of France could read it in that language, and it could be read by English speakers as well. And later on, it was translated to other languages. So it went from being the most top-down private notes imaginable to being something that Herzl was actively campaigning around the world to get into as many hands as he possibly could. And that process of showing flexibility, not about the end, but about the means, is part of the genius of Herzl. Part of his genius is also recognizing that he could make himself a public person, which he very much had not wanted to be in the initial stages. And that's why a good chunk of the lecture is devoted to that transition, because without that transition, there wouldn't have been a book called The Jewish State, and there wouldn't have been a Jewish state called Israel.
He must have also had to change the framing and rhetorical argument of the book, because a pitch which is designed to persuade the aristocratic Western European Jews is not exactly the same as you would imagine that you'd want to use to inspire and persuade the foot soldiers of the East.
That is true, although to a very large extent this remained a book focused, I think, on its initial Western European leadership, although that's a subject of some debate among biographers. What you do see, and part of what makes Herzl such a fascinating figure, is he allows us to look into his mind in real time. He begins around the time of his meeting with Baron Hirsch, keeping a set of diaries to deal with the Jewish question, to deal with the Jewish problem. And although he always meant for the diaries to be published at some stage, he nonetheless revealed a great deal of himself, almost as if it were a private diary. And so we know more or less the moment in mid-November of 1895 when he removed all of the references to the Rothschild family, which until then had played a very significant role within this text, and made it something that could be read out to others and later could be published and read by others. So he takes away very particularist arguments about how this was in the interest of the Rothschild family to preserve their fortune, which otherwise would be lost, by using that fortune to create this Jewish state, which was going to redound to their benefit as well. But you also see he does change the arguments over time. Stephen Beller, who wrote an intellectual biography of Herzl, I think has done a very good job in comparing the different versions, but you can see that this becomes both more mature. Some of the more fantastic ideas, fantastic in its fantasy sense, are taken out. Additional inspiration is put into it. As he's trying his ideas out on people and hearing objections, he changes the text so that he will deal with his objections. I mean, it literally is a work in progress. And Herzl himself is a work in progress, and you get to see all of that happening by reading his diaries and then reading his masterpiece, The Jewish State. In our first lecture, we began in June of 1895 with that fateful meeting between Theodor Herzl and Baron Hirsch. We laid out the three main challenges that anyone launching a Jewish state at that time in the late 19th century would face: the intellectual challenge, the political institutional challenge, and the diplomatic challenge. And we considered briefly what some of the assets were that anybody would have in making that effort. In lecture two, though, cognizant of the fact that it wasn't just anyone who chose to launch that state, but Theodor Herzl himself, we went very much into depth, both regarding his biography, but especially regarding the things that he brought to the table: his Jewish attitudes, his education and experience, his character, and certain other assets that he had by dint of where he was born, who he was born to, who he was married to, and even what he looked like. We're now ready to dig into the most difficult and, I think, fulfilling part, which is to see how did Herzl play the cards that he had? How did he go about meeting these challenges in order to build a Jewish state? Now, what has to be clear to us is that Herzl knew he was launching a campaign. His meeting with Hirsch had failed in even the simplest sense, which is he only made it through 6 out of the 22 pages he was hoping to make it through. He was left with even greater passion than before for building this state, and he knew that any campaign has to begin with the right strategic move, and if you don't do so, the whole campaign might very well be doomed. And he wrestled. He wrestled in a way that's actually beautiful, that's inspiring, that's scary sometimes when you read about it. And he was remarkably open about that wrestling process in his diaries. I should add that while many people consider The Jewish State, Der Judenstaat, to be a great book in the classic sense, one that's worth studying and studying closely, many of Herzl's biographers believe that his diaries also fall in that category, and I very much follow in their footsteps and am going to treat it that way. So what I'd like to do during the course of this lecture is at some length consider the process that Herzl went through in order to reach the decision of what his first step should be. And after that, since we all know that that first step ended up being the publication of The Jewish State, we're going to delve into the meaning of that book. There's a lot to be unpacked in Der Judenstaat, so we'll begin it in this, the third lecture, and we'll complete it in the fourth lecture when we'll also go on to consider the impact that this book had. Let's then move directly to Herzl. It's now June 1895. He's had his meeting with Hirsch. He's fired off his follow-up letter after that meeting. And now he has to figure out what to do. And he knows he has to play to his strengths, and he also knows inside that he isn't as clear about his ideas as he probably thought he was going into the meeting. The process of writing that follow-up letter clarified it to him further, and he knew there was more ground to be covered. So when you're a writer, a born writer, somebody who spent pretty much all of his conscious life writing, and you have a problem to solve, you solve that problem by writing. And he sat down, and he began writing. That's actually a misnomer, because he didn't just sit down and begin writing. As he later describes it, he wrote in this manic state. He wrote when he first got up in the morning. He wrote in the middle of the day. He wrote when he was standing up. He wrote while he was walking. He wrote while he was in the French Chamber of Deputies covering political developments. He wrote at night. He would get up in the middle of the night from his sleep and write, each time on different scraps of paper. Not only was he writing in a way that was somewhat disjointed, but he also let his imagination go, and deliberately so. And since the diaries are a great book, I don't want to do too much paraphrasing, and I don't want to do too much summarizing. I want to read this to you as it happened to Herzl, as he described it in real time. This is how he characterized his own notes that he was writing down. "Much in these notes will seem ludicrous, exaggerated, crazy. But if I had exercised self-criticism, as I do in my literary work, my ideas would have been stunted. However, the gigantic serves the purpose better than the dwarfed, because anyone can do the trimming easily enough. Artists will understand why I, otherwise of rather clear intelligence, have let exaggerations and dreams proliferate among my practical, political, and legislative ideas, as green grass sprouts among cobblestones. I could not permit myself to be forced into the straitjacket of sober facts. This mild intoxication has been necessary." What's he describing here? See, these notes were of two kinds. Part of it was describing what this Jewish state was going to be like. What would the symbols be? What would the legislature be? What would the legislation be? What kind of people would be there? What would its relations be with its neighbors? And part of it was describing, how do you get from here to there? Right? It's well and good to describe a Jewish state in its ideal form, but the hardest part wasn't sustaining it once it existed. The hardest part was going from a situation where the Jewish state seemed the most improbable idea out there to a state where it seemed necessary and real and actually happening. And so Herzl wrote these kinds of notes, and he didn't restrict himself too much. And that actually, I think, was the right approach, because the very idea that he was writing about was a little bit crazy. And if he had straitjacketed himself and thought as he was writing, what would somebody say about this, and am I absolutely sure I believe that, he might not have had, probably would not have had, the same kind of creativity, wouldn't have the same depth of ideas, and wouldn't have the same material to work from when he was ready to sit down and transcribe it into a more finished product. But this is a rationalist approach to it. And Herzl was actually quite straightforward in acknowledging that this wasn't just him sitting down and saying, okay, I have these three challenges. I know about them because Dr. Palasar has mentioned them in a lecture he's going to give. And how am I going to overcome each of them given the strengths that have also been mentioned and that everybody knows? Something was happening to Herzl. It wasn't just that Herzl was causing something. And I want you to listen very carefully to his description of what was going on. "For me, these notes are not work, but only relief. I am writing myself free of the ideas which rise like bubbles in a retort and would finally burst the container if they found no outlet. In my clean copy, I am still on my conversation with Hirsch." This is a reference to the fact that there is a very nice 22-page version of this that lays things out clearly, but that's the clean copy. There's now this broader one. "But the growth of the new ideas is more important. Who knows how soon it is going to stop? Am I working it out? No. It is working itself out in me. It would be an obsession if it were not so rational from beginning to end. An earlier term for such a condition was inspiration." This was indeed inspiration. He said, I literally don't know when it's going to stop. He just feels almost as if he's been blessed with something. At times, I'm sure he felt like he was cursed with it, but it was coursing through him, through his veins, through his thoughts, through his day, through everything. And one of the things that makes Herzl, I think, so compelling as a leader is his openness in sharing these thoughts and feelings as he's doing it in a document, his diaries, that he was planning to publish. So he was sharing it with himself and he was sharing it with us, and he gives us a rare insight into what it means to be a leader in a moment of creative genius very much at the edge of your comfort zone, thinking thoughts you hadn't had before, thoughts that force you to consider whether you're even crazy or rational. But that is apparently what genius is like, or at least what genius is like in many situations, and it's nice to have a close-up of this one. Now, I had said earlier that Herzl was both a hard worker and somebody capable of these manic fits. And so starting with his 22 clean pages and his note-taking, which his father dutifully transcribed for him, Herzl within 10 days had enough material to go on to the next iteration. And while he was writing, he wasn't sure of his target audience. In a sense, he was his target audience, figuring out first what he thought, but now he had to really consider who this was going to. And he had two choices in mind, but the dominant view in his own mind was when plan A, Baron Hirsch, fails, then you go to plan B, the other barons, the Rothschilds, the other great, wealthy, banking, philanthropic Jewish family. And so what he put together was an address to the Rothschilds. Again, the playwright. He has the scene pictured. He, this upstart 35-year-old journalist who's known by his calling card and his newspaper, but is hardly on the in the Rolodex of the Rothschilds as a phone call, metaphorically, that they simply must make in that moment. He pictures himself with all of the Rothschilds in a room together, and he's reading them an address. And the address is, as we'll see, 78 pages long. So apparently they are, if nothing else, a very patient family. And once he gets to that stage where he's putting together something coherent, again, only 10 days after he began this process of creativity, he starts to see things very, very clearly. And he starts to get enthusiastic in a way that I think can make others enthusiastic. And this is what he writes. The promised land, where it is all right for us to have hooked noses, black or red beards, and bandy legs without being despised for these things alone. Where at last we can live as free men on our own soil and die in peace in our own homeland. Where we too can expect honor as a reward for great deeds, where we shall live at peace with all the world, which we shall have freed through our own freedom, enriched by our wealth, and made greater by our greatness. Right? Already you can see the notes are turning into something much more polished, going through the eye of the journalist, of the dramatist, of the man who sees the scene, of the man filled with this Jewish pride and filled with this Jewish aching that the world as it exists is so far removed from the world as he thinks it could be. And he goes on. So that the derisive cry of Jew may become an honorable appellation, like German, Englishman, Frenchman, in short, like that of all civilized people. So that by means of our state we can educate our people for tasks which still lie beyond our horizon. For God would not have preserved our people for so long if we did not have another role to play in the history of mankind. Having spent about 10 days putting all of these notes on pieces of paper, it took him literally only 3 days to turn that into this final product, this 78-page address. And as he did so, he allowed some of the ambition to shine through. I spoke about ambition as one of Herzl's character traits, and I took the potentially controversial position that ambition, in this case unbridled ambition, wanton wild ambition, was actually essential. If he hadn't had this trait on top of the others, I don't think he could have gone through what he was going through. He couldn't have worked that hard. He couldn't have risked everything, risk being considered crazy by everybody he knew, risk being a laughingstock, which for a man of honor is perhaps the greatest risk of all. And here's what he wrote on June 15th in his diary. Today, I am an isolated and lonely man. Tomorrow, perhaps, the intellectual leader of hundreds of thousands. In any case, the discoverer and proclaimer of a mighty idea. He's a guy in a hotel room in Paris, and he's picturing this already out there with hundreds of thousands of people seeing him as the intellectual leader. Again, that ability to leap from the reality, however dreary it was, to a greater imagined future was one of his strengths, and of course one of the things for which his opponents never ceased to criticize him, his grasp of reality. But it wasn't that he couldn't grasp reality, it's that he could step from reality into an imagined world and then step back into that reality. In fact, with the strengths of a playwright, he's actually there as the ships come into the promised land. Listen to what it's like to be there. While I have been writing, and especially when I have seen in my mind's eye the solemn festive mood on the boats and the arrival, the gala reception on the other side, the promised land, I have often wept over the misfortunes of my people. Why is he weeping? Because he sees them both. He sees these people coming joyous to the promised land, a land where they can be just like Englishmen and Frenchmen and Germans. They can be just regular civilized people who are respected. And then in the selfsame moment, he's seeing them in their hovels, in the Pale of Settlement. He's seeing them trying to straitjacket themselves into assimilationists unsuccessfully in the capitals of Western Europe. And the gap between those two things, what ought to be and what is, it's eating at him, it's making him cry, but it's also making him work. And yet, the same Herzl who is a dramatist is the Herzl who was a journalist. And for 4 years in France, he observed what is the difference between a leader who succeeds and a leader who doesn't. And so in literally the next sentence, he writes, "But if I am to lead my people, I must not show any tears. The leader must have an impassive face." Again, the connection with reality never lost. It's always there. The question is just how to use it. I think we see so far what is in many respects his greatest strength. And that is that sense of Jewish honor, that sense of Jewish pride, and the sense of Jewish hurt that results from seeing things. I said earlier, and I think it bears repeating, great leaders are motivated not just by love, not just by the values they care about and the things they want. They're motivated to an extraordinary degree by looking at the world as it is and seeing some part of it, seeing it magnified, seeing it gigantic, and saying, "This cannot be. I can't live in a world like this, but I'm going to live and I'm going to change the world and make this a very, very different and better place." And Herzl is developing this more and more as he's writing himself into a frenzy and as he's writing himself into a possible role of greatness. Again, his ambition shines through at these moments as well, and it's a critical force. Listen to what he wrote on June 16th. He's now completed the address to the Rothschilds, hasn't delivered it to any Rothschilds, not yet clear if and when he will, but he has that product in his hand, and here's what he writes. "During these days, I have more than once been afraid I was losing my mind. This is how tempestuously the trains of thought have raced through my soul. A lifetime will not suffice to carry it all out." Again, he's flying on wings, and at the same time, he recognizes this is the work of a lifetime. "But I shall leave behind a spiritual legacy. To whom? To all men. I believe I shall be named among the greatest benefactors of mankind." Or is this belief already megalomania? There's some self-awareness, and yet he pushes through. "I believe that for me, life has ended and world history has begun." That's Herzl. In this mood, and yet he remained the practical man. So what does he do at this point? No laurels, no resting, but rather he is reaching out to anybody he knows who might be able to get him to one or more of the Rothschilds, because he's got this 78-page address and it's burning a hole in his pocket because he wants to deliver it, because once he delivers it, then the Rothschilds can act on it, and then this Jewish state might really happen. But it doesn't work. He's, despite efforts through this rabbi and that contact, this journalist, that author, he doesn't seem to be able to get into the door. But he doesn't give up hope. What does he do? He thinks back, who are the really great men? Right? And just as when he was speaking to Baron Hirsch, he had said, "I shall go to the Kaiser. The Kaiser, he will understand me. He was brought up to think great thoughts." He thinks about who is the greatest man of his time, and certainly one of the leading figures in his own mind for this was Otto von Bismarck,
the architect of German unity, arguably the greatest modern European diplomat, the greatest diplomat since Metternich. And so he takes out his pen and writes a beautiful letter to Bismarck and gets no response. So he's now tried going to the top people in the Jewish world, the top person in the non-Jewish world, in what Israelis would call a zbang v'gamarnu approach, the approach where you do one thing and that one thing just makes everything else happen. And yet he goes on step by step trying to reach contacts. And how does he do it? Somewhat incredibly, especially for a generation that doesn't always have the longest attention span, he sits with people with his 78 pages and says, I'd like to read you an address. And he reads to them, and apparently, at least based on his meeting with the chief rabbi of France, it takes 2 hours to read these 78 pages, and he reads them straight without an interruption. And people react in different ways. Some become his opponents, some become his advocates. But a rare thing happens in mid-November. This is 5 months after he's finished the address, still hasn't been able to give it to the one person or family who can really handle this decisively. And he meets with Max Nordau. Max Nordau was genuinely internationally famous. He wasn't just a household name in the sense that Herzl was, that when he pulls out his card and says, I'm the Feuilleton editor of the Neue Freie Presse, people say, oh, that's very important. I think I read one of your pieces. He is a household name. Right? He's written famous works on degeneration, on cultural degeneration, on the degeneration of art, of civilization, of mankind. And he had also been a correspondent in Paris in parallel to Herzl. And Herzl approaches him, reads him the full speech, and at least as Herzl describes it, Nordau will, I believe, go with me through thick and thin. He was my easiest conquest and possibly the most valuable to date. He would make a good president of our academy or a minister of education. So Nordau basically says, I'm all in. I'm with you in this. And he gives him advice. And his advice is, go to England, address the Maccabean Club of London, meet Israel Zangwill, who's a modestly well-known author, and see where that takes you. Now, Herzl was gifted in languages, but English was not, at this point, a language that he was able to speak in any reasonable way. He had done plenty of traveling for museums, traveling for landscapes, traveling to recover his often fragile health. But this was his first ever Zionist mission, where he was picking himself up and going to another country to meet people he hadn't known, to do public speaking, which is something he hadn't done a lot of since his collegiate days. And he picks himself up and he does it. Part of being a leader is stretching your comfort zone. And one of the reasons it was important to me to trace what was Herzl's comfort zone as of June 1895 was so that we could see together how he's stretching it as he goes forward. And then he notes, matter-of-factly, in a diary entry that I have to admit I missed the first couple of times I read it, but it's actually the strategic turning point in Herzl's thinking, writes as follows. November 19th. Nordau recommends that while in London, I should contact Hamagid and the Jewish Chronicle. I am to arrange for my pamphlet to be translated into Yiddish, also into Hebrew, for the Russians. Whoa! This was an address to the Rothschilds. It's a private thing. They're supposed to take it. But somewhere along the way, by seeing, on the one hand, the failure to get to the very top people, and yet the enthusiastic reactions of a Nordau and of others, Herzl has now conceptualized a very different strategy for how he's going to build this Jewish state. And that strategy is based on reaching out, not to the top of the pyramid of Western European Jewry, but he's reaching out to the Russians, to the Pale of Settlement, to the impoverished Jews, to the desperate Jews, to the traditional Jews, to the Jews who are most likely to hear him, but least likely to have the clout to take that one decisive action, at least on an individual level, to make this happen. Hamagid, the Hebrew press, he's reaching out to the most literate. The Jewish Chronicle, London is the financial capital of the world, And he's not reaching out to them in order to take out an ad. He's reaching out to them in order to get his ideas known. And this shift ultimately is what determines the fate, or shall I say the success, of the Zionist movement. When Herzl shifts from a man who's focused on the individual to somebody who's essentially his own publicist. How can I get this translated into more languages? How can I get it into more hands? And how can I speak about it to larger audiences? It's interesting to see how Herzl looked back at what he had written. Right? I shared with you his thoughts in real time about the process of writing and how he wasn't in control of it and so on. But as he looks back, and I think he was probably starting to look back already at this pamphlet, he saw that something very important had happened, and if it could get into the right hands, something of world historical significance would happen. And this is how he wrote about it years later in an autobiographical sketch in the Jewish Chronicle. "I cannot remember ever having written anything in such a mood of exaltation. Heine tells us that he heard the flapping of an eagle's wings above his head when he wrote certain verses. I, too, believe that I heard such a fluttering of wings while I wrote that book." The fluttering of wings was during the book, but now the book needs its own new wings to get out there. And so Herzl's in England. He spoke to Zangwill. He addressed the Maccabees. And to just give you an idea of the scene, he spoke to them spontaneously in three parts. The first two in German, with a translator after each part then giving a summary. The third part in French, I guess for the people whose German wasn't as good. And we know it was a success because he was elected immediately as an honorary member of the Maccabees. This was a proud Jewish club in England. And yet there were still those who resisted the idea of his going public with the pamphlet, with the address, with the book. Right, so there was a Reverend Paul Singer who thought, "The matter must first be submitted to the prominent Jews, Lord Rothschild, Mocatta, Montefiore, and the like." Herzl, whose dream only a few months before had been to submit this to the Rothschilds of the world, responded, "You can't make me yield to majorities. This is the cause of the poor Jews, not of the rich ones. The protest of the latter is null, void, and worthless." Right, having gone from being the center of this plan, the wealthy Jews very quickly were people who didn't even get a veto. This had to be brought out to the Jews most deeply affected. In fact, a couple of weeks later, when the chief rabbi of France suggested that Herzl should send the pamphlet to Edmund Rothschild, again, what had been Herzl's dream, Herzl's response is, "I wouldn't dream of it." Fascinating choice of language, because he had been dreaming of nothing but for many, many weeks. Again, the hallmark of a leader. You deliberate, you're creative, you're open to other points of views, you're thinking it through, you're showing your doubts in real time, but there comes a certain moment when you recognize what is the deed you need to do, and then you are full steam ahead. And at this point, we're encountering a Theodor Herzl who is full steam ahead. What does that look like? Well, anybody who's ever published a book knows the first thing you do is you go to the publishers and you offer your manuscript. And the second thing that you do is you deal with rejection, because your manuscript gets turned down. And German language publisher after German language publisher turned it down, and of course Herzl had written it in his most native language, the language in which he was best. He briefly considered self-publishing it, but again, with that practical bent and focused on his image, he realized that if it sells well after he self-published it, quote, "I would look like a businessman." And he means that in the negative sense. People would think he was in this for the money. He gets a publisher soon enough, but before he does that, it comes out, the first version of the Jewish state, the Precy version, the first serial rights, we'll call it, but it's really a summary of the whole book, comes out in the Jewish Chronicle in English. And it's shortly after that that the Breitenstein publisher says that they're interested in doing it. Herzl, again, typically a writer, writes in his diary, "I now have the sense of relief that comes from the completion of a job. Success I do not expect." And these variations between being of world historical significance and not sure what's going to happen. February 4th. My publisher, Breitenstein, wants to have a first printing of only 3,000 copies. He has no confidence as yet in its commercial success. Now, in that day and age, 3,000 copies of a first print run, pretty darn good, but it wasn't everything that Herzl wanted. But in some ways, the most poignant moment is 10 days later. It's February 14th. The book is about to be in the stores. The moment of truth when people either start snatching it up and reading it and thinking he's a genius, or snatching it up and thinking he's crazy, or worst option of all, ignoring it. Herzl writes, "My 500 copies came this evening. When I had the bundle carted to my room, I was terribly shaken. This package of pamphlets constitutes the decision in tangible form. My life may now take a new turn. Then I went to the office. I recalled the fisherman on the Seewiesen at the Alt Aussee Lake who said, 'The most remarkable thing is a man's never giving up hope.'" Herzl had never given up hope. He knew he would find some way to take that first step, and he hoped it would be a decisive way. I want to pause for a moment to consider what was his strategy, now that we've seen it evolve, and I think parts of it have become clear, but I think we need to look now at his strategy and contrast it to his goals. Part one, he wrote what he wrote to develop his own ideas. Walter Lippmann, the great journalist and writer, was asked once, "What do you think about such and such subject?" And he said, "I don't know. I haven't written about it yet." There's until he had written something, he didn't know what his opinion was, and Herzl, who was on the edge of what was between a brilliant dream and a fantasy, couldn't know what he thought until he wrote it. So for the simplest thing in his strategy was he wrote in order to understand what were his ideas of how to build a Jewish state and what were his ideas for what that Jewish state ought to look like. But his strategy in publishing it, I think, has to be linked to the three challenges he faced. Number one, the intellectual challenge. He recognized that his words, uninterrupted, were probably the best way to persuade people of the desirability and the feasibility of a Jewish state. And so he wrote them and he published them because he believed that this would persuade people. In the next lecture, we'll talk about what the responses were, and we'll see that he was not wrong in recognizing the power of these words on the intellectual side. But second, this book was also a brilliant move in terms of the political and institution building development, because when he first put this out, he would not have been on anybody's top 100 list, maybe not on anybody's top 1,000 list of people likely to assume and be granted a mantle of Jewish leadership. By putting out this book with the provocative title Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State, and laying things out in the clear way that we'll see momentarily, he was putting himself forward as a candidate for leadership within the Jewish world, and he was also making himself a magnet for those people, whether they could be generals in his army or foot soldiers in his army, who had the potential to be part of building a movement internationally with institutions that can endure over decades, and that together they would be able to build this Jewish state. So the book had a purpose intellectually, it had a purpose politically, I think it also had a purpose diplomatically. No, he didn't think that the Sultan was going to read this and say, "What was I thinking? Of course there should be a Jewish state there. Let's get the ball rolling." And he didn't even think that the Kaiser would act that way, even though it was written in the Kaiser's language, and the Kaiser, as we know, was a man brought up to think great thoughts. But what Herzl did understand is that in order to be successful diplomatically, you have to have a seat at the table. And not only did he need a seat at the table, but the Jewish people needed a seat at the table. So he first had to get the Jews on his side and then build them up as a movement so that if you're a great power looking at the Jews, you're actually seeing someone who, if not an equal, is at least capable of having a chair at that table. Maybe the chair is a little bit lower, maybe they don't get served so early, maybe they get interrupted, but it was a seat at the table, and so he was laying the conditions for having a seat at that table, not only for himself, but for his people. That, I think, is the strategy of the book. And what I'd like to now turn to in the time we have remaining for this lecture is to at least begin the discussion of what is the contents of this book, Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State. Very worthwhile to do. I think a case could be made that this was the most important Jewish book written since the Talmud a millennium and a half ago. I know many people could argue with that. There have been lots of important books, but if you look at what was the impact of this book, I think you could make the case that nothing transformed the Jewish world as much since the Talmud as this book did. I want to give it the kind of care that it deserves. So as I did with the diaries, I want to delve inside. And whenever I have the choice between my paraphrasing and Herzl's language, I'm going to choose Herzl's language, but I'll try to help interpret it as we go along. So I want you to begin by putting yourself in the position of a reader. Choose your language. You could be a reader in German. You could be a reader in French and English, Hebrew, Yiddish, all of these and others came out during that first year, during 1896. And these are the words that first confront you. The idea which I have developed in this pamphlet is a very old one. It is the restoration of the Jewish state. The world resounds with outcries against the Jews, and these outcries have awakened the slumbering idea. I wish it to be clearly understood from the outset that no portion of my argument is based on a new discovery. I have discovered neither the historic condition of the Jews nor the means to improve it. In fact, every man will see for himself that the materials of the structure I am designing are not only in existence, but actually already in hand. If, therefore, this attempt to solve the Jewish question is to be designated by a single word, let it be said to be the result of an inescapable conclusion rather than that of a flighty imagination. Right. First few sentences, what has he already done? Boom, he's put out on the table the idea. This is not about a Jewish homeland. This is not about emigration. This is not about an improvement in our condition. This is the restoration of the Jewish state. That's number one. It's a revolutionary opening to a book. Being a wise man, the very next thing he does is to tell people, nothing revolutionary happening here. All of these ideas are old. All of these ideas have been with us. All of these ideas, therefore, are practical. Because he's reaching out, he knows, to the Russian Jews, they don't want a revolution. And they certainly don't want a revolution against Jewish ideas. But he's also reaching out to the people who are going to think he's a megalomaniac for having developed this completely new worldview and trying to persuade people. So he says, relax. This isn't my idea. This is an idea that was around. I'm just taking something that was there and translating it into a modern idiom. That's how the book opens. But the preface ends with a particularly, I think, powerful set of phrases as follows. I shall therefore clearly and emphatically state that I believe in the practical outcome of my scheme, though without professing to have discovered the shape it may ultimately take. The Jewish state is essential to the world. It will therefore be created. The plan would, of course, seem absurd if a single individual attempted to do it. But if worked by a number of Jews in cooperation, it would appear perfectly rational, and its accomplishment would present no difficulties worth mentioning. The idea depends only on the number of its supporters. Perhaps our ambitious young men, to whom every road of progress is now closed, seeing in this Jewish state a bright prospect of freedom, happiness, and honors opening to them, will ensure the propagation of the idea. What has he done there? His readers are thinking, does he really mean this? Is this a utopia? Does he believe in this? Could this really happen? And in their heart of hearts, they want to be reassured that the man who wrote this believes in it. And so he tells them as clearly as he possibly could, it is essential to the world. It will therefore be created. But he knows that they're thinking in their heads, as my father of blessed memory would have put it, yeah, you and how many others your size? And there's, you're going to create this Jewish state? And he says, no, you are going to create this Jewish state. Right? If worked by a number of Jews in cooperation, it would appear perfectly rational, and its accomplishment would present no difficulties worth mentioning. And part of the genius of the book is that he turns the tide as he does in this next paragraph. Am I stating what is not yet the case? Am I before my time? Are the suffering of the Jews not yet grave enough? We shall see. It depends on the Jews themselves whether this political pamphlet remains for the present a political romance. If the present generation is too dull to understand it rightly, a future, finer and a better generation will arise to understand it. The Jews who wish for a state shall have it, and they will deserve to have it. What's he doing? He's saying, it doesn't depend on me, it depends on you. The idea isn't mine, it's an idea that has always belonged to all of us and can come to fruition only if it belongs to all of us. And as you're reading this, you're thinking back to the Theodor Herzl who for 4 years watched politics in the political epicenter of Europe, in France, and watched what worked and what didn't. And he clearly understood that if you transfer responsibility to your readers, if they recognize that if this state happens, it's because of them. And if the state doesn't happen, it's because they failed. The state will happen in the end. Ultimately, there will be people wise enough and spirited enough to bring it about. But what's essential to understand for them is that if they will it, it is no dream. And that's what Herzl is challenging them to think about already in the beginning of this book. Now, I want to just touch on the introduction, which follows the preface, because here Herzl introduces two more of the big ideas that dominate this book. The first of these is anti-Semitism, and Herzl, quite deservedly, is known for his focus on anti-Semitism as the engine of building the Jewish state. And here's how he puts it in what I think is one of his more memorable passages. The Jewish question still exists. It would be foolish to deny it. It is a remnant of the Middle Ages, which civilized nations do not even yet seem able to shake off, try as they will. They certainly showed a generous desire to do so when they emancipated us. Break for a moment. What he's telling his West European Jewish readers is, I'm with you. I understand Jewish emancipation, our getting our freedom, our getting our rights, our getting the ability to integrate economically. This is all very powerful, and there were genuine motives that went behind it. People really wanted to help us, right? He didn't want to appear tone deaf, but he goes on. The Jewish question exists wherever Jews live in perceptible numbers. Where it does not exist, it is carried by Jews in the course of their migrations. We naturally move to those places where we are not persecuted, and there our presence produces persecution. This is the case in every country and will remain so even in those highly civilized, for instance, France. Until the Jewish question finds a solution on a political basis, the unfortunate Jews are now carrying the seeds of anti-Semitism into England. They have already introduced it into America. On the one hand, he's telling them, if you try to fight anti-Semitism by staying in the countries that you're in right now, you will not succeed. If you try to fight anti-Semitism by moving to a different country, you'll just bring anti-Semitism into that country. If you try to fight anti-Semitism by building a Jewish state, then, as he'll lay out later on, you have a real chance to succeed in that goal. So his first theme in the introduction is anti-Semitism, the inevitability of anti-Semitism, something on which he waxes eloquent and poetic and, I think, persuasive. And then comes the thunderbolt. It doesn't look like a thunderbolt to many of us today, but we have to understand what it was in 1896 for Jews around the world who saw themselves as belonging to a religion, but not necessarily a people, who saw themselves cut off, unable to travel to, unable to communicate with other Jews, to read from this literate, well-known, brilliant, Western journalist and playwright, we are a people, one people. That got into their kishkes. That got into their guts. Anti-Semitism affected all of them, but the idea that, you know what? We are a people, one people. Building a state is something that is in our hands. Fighting it in Europe doesn't work because it cannot work, because human nature won't allow it to work. But we are a people, one people. We have a destination, one destination. By the middle of Herzl's introduction, his readers, the sensitive ones, the thoughtful ones, already were thinking about how they, as a people, one people, could build a state, one state that would redound to the benefit of all mankind. And it is with that story of how Herzl continues to persuade them as the first step towards building that state that we'll continue in our next lecture.
Dr. Palliser, now having watched this lecture, in which you introduce us to the Jewish state, the writing of the Jewish state. Could you just elaborate on some of the ideas that fuel the Jewish state?
So one of the first of those ideas is that this is not new. It was very important for Herzl to lay out that his entire vision of restoring a Jewish state was something that had been around for millennia. And he modestly says there's nothing new in this book in terms of a Jewish state. That was important, especially because of the more traditionalist elements within his constituency, which needed to make sure this was not something revolutionary. This came to them almost straight out of their Bible and straight out of their prayer book. At the same time, there is a very significant role in the book, and each time I go back and read it and reread it, I'm struck by just how central a place he gives to anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is the engine, the force of power that is going to drive the Jewish state. If it were not for anti-Semitism, there couldn't be a Jewish state, or at least you couldn't form it. You could have one that exists and continues to exist even without anti-Semitism, but the spark that was going to light it, but more than just the spark, the engine that was going to power the Jews and their allies around the world to build this Jewish state was anti-Semitism, which he saw as being not only potent, but really inevitable. As long as there's no Jewish state, there will always be suspicions of Jews. They will always be forced down. As he puts it, anti-Semitism rises up in the places that have Jews in them. That drives Jews to areas that don't have Jews in them. And their very presence in these new areas imports anti-Semitism. He writes that anti-Semitism is being imported, even as he speaks and writes, into England and into the United States. So anti-Semitism, I think, is a second idea that plays a key role. The third thing is technology. Herzl was fascinated with technology from an early age, and he never lost that fascination. He writes, and I think with real sincerity, that a Jewish state couldn't have been formed 50 or 100 years ago. The technology wouldn't have been made possible the transporting of hundreds of thousands and then millions of people to a new land which he saw as a relatively undeveloped land. The building of houses couldn't have been done. The financial arrangements couldn't have been done. The wealth didn't exist to make this kind of a thing possible. And because of the union of the ancient dream together with the new technology, spurred on by a necessity caused by anti-Semitism, those things would be the key elements in building a Jewish state.
How does the establishment of a political sovereignty for the Jewish people solve the problem of anti-Semitism?
He believed that anti-Semitism was caused in large part by resentment of Jews for their success and for their competing with others. In particular, he was concerned about middle-class and intellectual Jews who were the fiercest competitors in the countries that they lived in significant numbers. And he believed that if you could take what he sometimes referred to as the excess Jews from these countries, beginning with the desperados, the poor, most downtrodden Jews, and move them in very large numbers to Palestine, to the land of Israel, and then after they had created a beachhead, begin moving some of the more middle-class Jews, the ones who were competing for wealth and competing for fame in a variety of countries, if you could do that, then the source of anti-Semitism, this resentment of the non-Jews for the Jews, would dissipate. I think there was also an element of removing the claim of dual loyalty, because if you moved Jews in large numbers to a Jewish state and you created that state, then by definition, any Jew who didn't choose to move to that state had determined that he was a Frenchman, he was a German, she was a Russian, she was an Englishwoman, and therefore, there wouldn't be a suspicion that in their heart of hearts what they really wanted was to pick up and move to a Jewish state if only they could. Because they could. It was a very real thing. And that combination of removing the individual competition with Jews and removing the taint, the constant suspicion of double loyalty, Herzl believed that together those things would help remove anti-Semitism.
So it means that the Jewish people would be protected from anti-Semitism that persists, or that the establishment of a Jewish state would make anti-Semitism vanish?
It would make it vanish. That by moving the Jews to Israel, you would remove anti-Semitism in the countries in which Jews remained. And I have to add one other factor. Herzl cared deeply about Jewish honor and Jewish greatness, and he really believed in the depths of his being, and correctly as it turned out, that if you built a Jewish state, the Jews would attain greatness. They could serve as a model to others, maybe not a perfect model, and he writes about some of the imperfections, but that they would restore the sense that the Jews were a people born in greatness and destined for greatness, and that that too would blunt anti-Semitism, because others would look and see not these poor peddlers, not these Jews who had what Herzl himself saw as kind of a corrupted character over time, but that they would stand up straight again, that they would be great men again, that they would be proud people, and they would achieve according to that greatness.